You know, it's real interesting when you go to a lot of different talks by people that are Buddhist, that they very seldom talk about basic teaching of the Buddha, which is the Four Noble Truths. I mean, that's the whole point of doing meditation. That's the whole point of the Buddha spending 45 years in teaching. But it seems like there's an awful lot of freelance ideas and trying to incorporate different kinds of psychotherapy and different kinds of practices into the Buddha's teaching. And they need to be real careful with that sort of thing, especially what's happening on the West Coast with Spirit Rock. The basic teaching of the Buddha is that there is suffering. Now, everybody knows that to be a fact. Everybody knows that there is suffering that happens. It's not like it happens all the time, but there's things that happen that you don't want to happen. There's things that happen that you wish would happen, and they don't happen in the way you'd like them to happen. And that's a form of suffering. There's a lot of emotional states that can arise, and that's a form of suffering. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering is craving. And when you're practicing meditation, craving always manifests as tension or tightness arising in your mind and in your body. Now, when we practice meditation, if you practice the way that the Buddha teaches in the suttas, there's four sentences that give you the entire teaching. It's very simple and very straightforward. He's talking about mindfulness of breathing, but it also has to do with every kind of meditation that he taught. And it says that a person, when they take a long breath in, they understand their breath is long when they're breathing in. When they're breathing out, they know the breath is long when they're breathing out. They know the breath is short. They know the breath is breathing in and out. The key word in these instructions is that you understand. You don't keep your attention on the breath, but you use the breath as a reminder that this is your home base. The next part of the instructions, they say that on the in-breath you experience the entire body, and on the out-breath you experience the entire body. It's not talking about the breath body, it's talking about the physical body. Then it says, you train thus. On the in-breath you tranquilize your bodily formation. On the out-breath you tranquilize your bodily formation. So on the in-breath it's relax, on the out-breath it's relax. Any tension or tightness that you see in your physical body, the tension and tightness that you will see most often is the tension and tightness that happens in your head. And then you relax that. Now, when you relax, especially the tightness in your head, you will see that your mind kind of expands and then becomes calm. And then you bring that mind back to your object of meditation. If you're practicing meditation without that extra step of relaxing, then you're practicing a form of absorption concentration. And this does not lead to the same place that what the Buddha was teaching and talking about. Tension and tightness, craving manifests as tension and tightness in your mind and in your body. So when you relax the tension and tightness, what are you doing? You're recognizing that there is craving, and you're letting go of the craving. And that's the third noble truth. The cessation of suffering is the cessation of craving. So many times during your practice in meditation, you wind up letting go and relaxing on the in-breath, on the out-breath. Your mind becomes distracted. You don't watch a thought until it goes away. You let go of the thought right then and relax, and then come back to your object of meditation. And every time you do that, you are experiencing the third noble truth, which is the cessation of suffering. The fourth noble truth is the path leading to the cessation of suffering, which is the cessation of the craving. It's the way of letting go of the craving. There's eight different factors for letting go of the craving, and you do these almost all at the same time. Now, this kind of meditation that I'm talking about also is important when you're practicing something like loving-kindness meditation, which is what I generally teach. I do teach mindfulness of breathing, and there's some other meditations that I teach too, but they're all basically the same thing. It's when your mind becomes distracted, let go of the distraction. How do you let go of the distraction? You let it be there by itself. You don't pay attention to it anymore. So a thought comes, you don't continue thinking it. You just let it be there, and then you relax and bring your attention back to your object of meditation. It doesn't matter how many times your mind wanders away. Every time you notice that your mind has got caught in thinking this or that, then let go of the thought. Even if you're in mid-sentence, just let go of it. Relax and come back to your object of meditation. If you start getting involved with the thinking, then you're not meditating anymore. If you have the idea that these thoughts are too important and I need to continue thinking them, then you're thinking, you're not meditating. But a lot of different meditation practices, they try to teach you how to blank your mind. And they don't really tell you how to do it. But they treat any kind of thinking mind as the enemy to try to fight with, and that's not really the case when you're talking about a Buddhist type of meditation. It's allowing that distraction to be there. Why do you allow it? Because it's a truth when it happens. That distraction is there. So you let it be there by itself and relax and come back to your object of meditation. Over a period of time, your mind will eventually become less distracted by these thoughts that keep coming up, and they'll start to stay with your object of meditation more easily and for longer periods of time. Now, when I'm teaching loving kindness meditation, I teach that it is a smiling meditation, and I want everybody to smile while they're doing it. Now, one of the things that I found, I spent 12 years in Asia, and I've had Asian teachers for more than 20 years. One of the things that I found is that there is a difference between Asians and Americans. And that difference is not in how their mind works, but in the amount of effort that they need to put into the practice. The Asians are generally more laid back. They're more happy. They're not so goal-oriented. So the Asian teachers are continually telling them, you have to try harder. You have to put in more effort. You have to put in more energy. Don't slack. Keep going. But when an American goes over to an Asia country and they hear that we're already goal-oriented and we already try real hard, and then we put that on top of it, we wind up hurting ourselves, basically what it boils down to. So what I've come to realize is that Americans, in particular, they don't need to put more energy and more effort into the practice. They need to put less, because they're trying too hard. You know, this is the fast food era. We want everything to happen really fast, and we want it to happen when we want it to happen. And when it doesn't, then we'll run off to another kind of discipline and hope that that one will do it. And that's why the spiritual supermarket of America has really come into being, because everybody wants instant enlightenment. When I have people practicing loving kindness meditation, one of the things that I tell them is that this is a game that you need to play. You need to smile, and if your mind gets caught by some big distraction, you need to laugh with yourself for getting caught by that distraction. And that means anger, anxiety, depression, fear, whatever the catch of the day happens to be, sadness. So when you can laugh at getting caught by an emotional state, you're not caught by it anymore. It goes from, I'm mad and I don't like it, to, oh, it's only this anger. Nothing. It's easy to let go of. Now, what just happened when you do that? You've changed your perspective. You've changed your view of the world by changing and not taking everything so personally and not trying to control your thoughts and emotions with your mind. By laughing at getting caught, you're not caught anymore. It changes your view. That's the first part of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the first part of, they always call it right understanding, but I change the phraseology a little bit and I call it harmonious perspective. And the way I found out about this was one day I was working for somebody and I was not getting paid for doing it. I just did it out of the goodness of my heart, and all of a sudden they thought they were my boss. And they started telling me how to do this and do that, and it's like, No, I'm not going to put out any more energy for you. You're not giving any energy back. I'm just doing this because I want to. I'm not doing it because I have to. And I was pretty angry about that whole situation, and I started thinking that this clown thinks that he's my boss and I'm giving him all of my energy. And I started walking away, driving my heels into the ground real heavy, thinking what a turkey this guy was. And I started to laugh at the whole situation in my mind. And then I saw that change from, I don't like this, to, it's only this anger. And it wasn't mine. I wasn't angry anymore. It was just this impersonal feeling that was there. So the more I explored that with other mental states whenever they came up, and I started laughing with these things instead of taking them so seriously, I started noticing that these incredibly heavy mental states that look so big and so intense while I was going through them were actually just these little bumps that I had built up in my mind to make into a big mountain of trouble. So when I learned how to change my perspective, change my view of what was arising in the present moment, when I was able to laugh with that and not take it personally anymore, it was very much easier to let go of that. And that was leading to the cessation of suffering. The next part of the Eightfold Path is called right thought, but I changed that to harmonious imaging. When you're sitting, say, with loving kindness, the instructions in the loving kindness are for you to make a wish for your own happiness and then feel that wish. Now, you know what it feels like to be peaceful and calm. You know what it feels like to be happy. You know what it feels like to be joyful. Bring that feeling into your heart. Okay, what you're doing is bringing an image into your heart. So this is harmonious imaging. And you stay with that as long as you can. When mind starts to waver a little bit and become distracted, then you can let go of that and then make another wish and bring that in. So you can keep that going. After a while, your mind starts to get the idea of it, and it becomes easier and easier. But it is bringing in an image. Now, there are some hindrances that can arise when you're doing meditation, but they also arise during your daily life. These hindrances, when they come up, they make your mind very emotional. They make your mind very unstable, and it takes you completely away from being in the present moment. It puts you in concept land. It puts you in confusion. Now, the first hindrance is lust, or the I want it mind. The next one is hatred, or the I don't want it mind. Or there's sleepiness and dullness. Your mind is dulls out for periods of time. There's restlessness and anxiety, and there's doubt. Whenever these arise, they will completely take your mind away from the present moment and get you caught up in concepts and ideas. that don't have anything to do with what you're doing right now, that just takes you away. Now, restlessness is one that everybody experiences, and it's that feeling of, I've got to move. I can't stand sitting here. You feel anxious. Now, the only way that you can overcome restlessness is by sitting very still and then watching your mind run all over the place. So you let that go and you relax, and then you bring up the image of a mind that's very peaceful and calm, and you feel that peace and calm. Now your mind's going to go back to that running around for a little while, but every time you notice it does, you let it go and relax, and then you bring that feeling of peace and calm. And in a very short time, your mind begins to settle down. So bringing up an image of peace and calm, an image of happiness, an image of joy, whatever it happens to be, and it seems appropriate at the time, then bring that feeling up and put it in your heart. Become that feeling. And your mind will become very peaceful and calm. So the change of your perspective and bringing up the imaging of these different feelings are very important to develop your understanding of how mind works. The next part of the Eightfold Path is called right speech, but I changed that to harmonious communication. And it's the communication that you have with yourself, mostly. How your mind gets critical, how your mind gets dissatisfied, and how you communicate with that. And when you're in harmony with yourself, you're able to communicate very clearly and let go of any kind of distracting thoughts and that sort of thing. The next part of the Eightfold Path is called right action, but I call it harmonious movement. It's the harmonious movement of watching mind's attention go from one thing to another and letting it be and bringing that attention back to your object of meditation. If you're practicing loving kindness meditation, it's that warm glowing feeling and the wish that you make and put that in your heart. If it's mindfulness of breathing, then you come back to the breath. But it's not just come back to the breath, it's come back to the breath and relax on the in-breath and relax on the out-breath. Those are the direct instructions that need to be practiced, because that changes your entire meditation. And what it does is it gets the meditator to practice tranquility and insight at the same time. And these are two words that are very much linked together in the suttas. In one sutta it says that serenity practice and insight are yoked together. Can't have one without the other. It's just like having two beasts of burden pulling a cart. One doesn't work. Takes both. The next part of the Eightfold Path is called right livelihood, but actually it has to do more with your harmonious lifestyle and how you practice your meditation, doing it in a harmonious way, doing it in a balanced way. Not being critical at yourself for getting caught by mental states, getting caught by hindrances, whatever arises. That's one of the things I found in coming back from Asia, is that most Americans are super critical of themselves. They're not forgiving of themselves at all. There's a standard that they think has to be met, and if it doesn't meet your expectation, then it's time to beat yourself up. And that's not the right kind of practice, because that's just getting involved with unwholesome thoughts. And the more you think and ponder unwholesome thoughts, the more your mind tends towards unwholesome thoughts. So the more you think and ponder on uplifting thoughts, on happy thoughts, the more your mind tends towards happy thoughts. It's just that simple. And this is kind of an amazing thing, because an awful lot of people that take up meditation, they have the idea that this is a lot tougher than it is, and it's a lot more complicated than it is. And then when you find out how truly simple it is, your mind goes, "No, it can't be that easy." Isn't that right? You see, when the Buddha gave his instructions, he used two sentences to give you the instructions on how to do the meditation. See your bodily formation, relax your bodily formation. And when you relax your bodily formation, you naturally relax your mind. That's the meditation. Anything other than staying with your object of meditation is a distraction. Let go of the distraction, whatever pulls your mind away. Relax, come back to your object of meditation, and relax continually while you're staying with your object of meditation. Can't get any simpler than that. It is very unfortunate that it's so simple that we forget and try to make it complicated. The next part of the Eightfold Path is it's called right effort by most translations, but I call it harmonious practice. And there's four parts to the harmonious practice. It's seeing an unwholesome state, letting go of the unwholesome state and relaxing, bringing up a wholesome state, staying with the wholesome state. That's pretty easy and straightforward. It's easy to talk about. But the whole thing is, anything other than your object of meditation is considered an unwholesome state. So you have to see that your mind is distracted. And when you first start meditating, your mind might get distracted for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. It doesn't really matter. As soon as you notice that your mind is doing that, then right then, you let go and you relax and you bring your mind back to your object of meditation. I have some students that they've been practicing for a long time, and they have the idea that their mind is always supposed to be peaceful and calm. And then when their mind is not peaceful and calm, they really become upset. And they start criticizing themselves, and they start pushing, and they start trying harder. And of course, that makes the meditation worse, because they're putting in too much effort, too much energy, and they're disliking what they're seeing so much that they're trying to control it. But they're not seeing the true process. Now, this is made up of five different things. You have a physical body. There are feelings. Feelings are pleasant, painful, neither pleasant nor painful. But we're just going to concern ourselves with the first two, the pleasant feeling and the painful feeling. There's perception. Perception is a thing that gives names to things. You look at these and you say, these are glasses. The mind that gave these that name, that's what perception is. And that also has memory involved with that. Then there's thoughts, and then there's consciousness. Now, when a feeling arises, it's painful or pleasant. And a feeling arises every time one of the sense doors comes up. Okay, a sense door is your eye, your ear, your nose, your tongue, your body, or your mind. In order to see, you have to have an eye in good working order. The eye has to hit color and form. Then eye consciousness arises. The meeting of these three is called contact, eye contact. And right, because with eye contact as condition, eye feeling arises. And the feeling is painful feeling or pleasant feeling. When that feeling arises, what we have the tendency to do is try to think the feeling away. You have a painful feeling arise, you stub your toe, you have an emotional feeling. It doesn't matter what kind of feeling it is. It's either painful feeling or pleasant feeling. It doesn't matter whether it's emotional or mental or physical. You treat them in the same way. When a feeling arises, our habitual tendency is to try to think the feeling away. Now, the more you try to think the feeling away, the bigger and more intense the feeling becomes, until it gets overwhelming. And this is the cause of depression. A painful feeling arises, you start wishing that it wasn't there. You don't like that feeling, you want it to go away. Feeling gets bigger and more intense. You start thinking and trying to push it away and distract yourself that much more. Feeling gets bigger and bigger, finally you just kind of close down. I'm depressed, leave me alone. But when I give the instructions in meditation, one of the things that I would tell you is that when a feeling arises and you notice that you're thinking about the feeling, the first thing you need to do is let go of the thought and relax. Now you see there's a tight mental fist wrapped around that feeling. That's aversion. You don't like it. You don't want to be disturbed by it. But the truth is, when a feeling arises, it's there. That's the truth. Anytime you try to fight with the truth, anytime you try to change the truth, anytime you try to make the truth be the way you want it to be, that's a cause of suffering, because you're doing that all with your thinking. Now, the truth is, when that feeling arises, it's there, and it it's all right for the feeling to be there. It has to be, because that's the truth. It's there. So you have to allow that feeling, even if it's a painful feeling, to be there. Relax and come back to your object of meditation. The nature of these kind of feelings when they arise, let's say it's a sensation in your body. You got a pain in your knee, or a pain in your back, whatever. You notice that you're thinking about it. Let go of the thoughts, relax. See that tight mental fist around the feeling? Let that feeling be there, relax. Come back to your object of meditation. It's going to bounce back and forth. That feeling is so strong that it'll keep pulling your attention to it, but you treat it in the same way every time. Now, one of two things is going to happen with that feeling. Either it's going to go away or it's not. If it goes away, fine, just stay with your object of meditation. If it doesn't go away, you start gaining more and more balance with that feeling, so it doesn't even distract you anymore. And if it doesn't distract you, then you just let it be. If your mind doesn't get pulled to it, let it be where it is. Let it be what it wants to be. And again, this is easy to say, it's easy to talk about, but when you get right down to the practice, because of our attachment to that, it's somewhat difficult. And what does attachment to the feeling mean? It means that I'm taking this feeling as mine personally, and I want it to be different than it is. But can you control the feeling? You can't do it with your thoughts, you know that. Did you ask that feeling to come up? No. You didn't say, well, I haven't had a crippling feeling in my back where I couldn't hardly move. I haven't had one of those for a while. It's time for me to have one. It comes up because the conditions are right for it to come up. What you do with what arises in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. If you resist what arises in the present moment, you try to fight with it, you try to control it, you can look forward to seeing that suffering more and more and more.
The truth. I just had a thought about my crippling back pain.
Yes.
There comes a point, though, where I just feel like maybe I should just sit in the futon, which is comfortable, and not try to work with it. And I sit in the futon, and the pain goes away.
And how long have you had that pain?
I know.
It always comes back, yeah.
I know.
So?
It's feeling like I'm running away by sitting in the futon.
I understand. For, I was around 8 years, I was sitting in meditation. Every time I started to go deep in meditation, I had a stabbing pain in my arm. Just like somebody took a knife, and I couldn't pick my arm up. I mean, it was really painful. And then one day, it just disappeared.
It develops and balance with it.
Yeah, it
always, like I said, it always takes me to the next level, you know.
Oh yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah.
I know, I always get fooled by it though.
Well, that's the way it really works. And now I don't sit with any pains. I mean, I got to a place when my teacher was telling me that I was getting into equanimity, but it wasn't real equanimity. But I got to a place where I went through incredibly intense pain. I mean, I know the kind of pain childbirth must be like, because I've gone through it.
It was
a different kind of pain.
Like you were progressing
further? Yeah.
I've heard about this.
Yeah. But it was like somebody took a red hot poker and just stuck it in there, and then they started moving it around. I mean, this was really intense pain. And after a while, it was there, but there was no reaction to it. And then the pain went away. And then it didn't matter how I sat, I couldn't make pain arise. Now, the kind of meditation I was doing was called Vipassana. And pain is a big part of watching. And when you can watch pain, pain is really a great object of meditation. Because it's there, it's really intense, it really holds your mind to it. But then I got to a place where I couldn't even make pain come up, and I went and complained to the teacher and said, I can't make pain arise anymore. It doesn't matter how I sit. I was sitting in such uncomfortable positions just to make pain arise, and it wouldn't come up. I don't recommend that kind of meditation for anybody else. Don't worry. I don't want you to have pain. I don't want you to sit in a way that makes pain arise. I want you to sit comfortably. Sometimes pain will arise by itself. And if it's real pain, then you get up from your meditation and you start hobbling and you can't, the pain stays with you. If it's meditation pain, you get up and you start walking, and all of a sudden, within 30 seconds, it disappears.
Yeah,
that's a meditation pain. That's a meditation pain. They happen. But it's what you do with what arises in the present moment that's so important. If you fight with what arises in the present moment and you try to control it with your thoughts or by tightening your mind around it, you can look forward to that pain coming back again and again and again and again until you learn from it. And what's the lesson you learn? The lesson you learn is that you have to allow the feeling to be there because it's the truth.
So while you're focusing, if you get distracted, you're strengthening your habitual patterns to be like involved with the pain, right?
I don't know what you're saying.
Say that again.
Well, being distracted by something, it's a habitual tendency to do that, right? Something arises, you're like, ooh, what's this? Let's investigate.
Well, but you don't need to investigate it by putting your attention in the middle of it and watching it until it goes away. You know that your mind is distracted by it, and you let it be and relax and come back. Now, if the pain is going to stay there, if that sensation is going to stay there, that means that your mind's attention is going to get pulled back to that. How did that happen? Okay, as you become more familiar with how your mind gets distracted, the amount of time that your mind is distracted becomes less and less and less.
Because you're able to see it quicker.
Because you're able to see it more quickly. And you start getting more and more of a sense of balance with it. It becomes more interesting watching the process of the movement of mind's attention than why it moves. why it moves. We don't care why. This is where a lot of the West Coast psychotherapists are getting very much confused about the meditation, because they want to use this as a therapy. And they want to know why things happen the way they happen. And that's for psychology, and psychology has its own place, but the place is not in Buddhism. Why is not the question that we're interested in. How the process works is what we're interested in. How does your mind's attention go from being on your object of meditation to being distracted? What happens? How does that process work? And as you start to become more familiar with the process, you stop identifying with these thoughts and feelings as being yours personally. You're starting to see them as just cause and effect relationships. When this arises, that arises. When this ceases, that ceases. And you start to see that. That's how you develop true insight. And the insight that you develop by doing this is the deep understanding of how dependent origination actually does work. Now, I've already given you a little taste of dependent origination. When your eye hits color and form, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of these three things is called eye contact. Because with eye contact as condition, eye feeling arises. With eye feeling as condition, eye craving arises. With eye craving as condition, clinging arises. What's clinging? All of the thoughts about why you like or dislike that feeling that arose. Now you're completely caught, and you're away from the present moment. You're not seeing this process anymore. You're becoming involved in the process. That's where the whys come in. The clinging is where your concepts and your opinions and these kind of things are formed. And that has to do with your thinking mind. But your observing mind is different than your thinking mind. Your thinking mind gets caught by habitual tendencies. Because this feeling arises this way, I always think about it in this way. But when you become more and more familiar as this as a process, you start recognizing that when the feeling arises, if you start relaxing right then there is no tension and tightness, there is no craving. And when there's no craving, there's no clinging. And if there's no clinging, there's no habitual tendency. So you've let go of suffering by letting go of the craving when it arises. And craving always manifests as tension and tightness. And you see me do this because that's where the subtle tension and tightnesses are. You have big gross tension and tightnesses. You're sitting in meditation and you have a tickle in your throat and you feel like you need to cough. The first thing you do is you have to let go of the thoughts about I don't want to cough, I don't want to disturb anybody, I just don't want to be disturbed by this. Every thought about the feeling makes the feeling more intense. So the first thing you do is relax and let go of the thoughts. See, that's the clinging. Now you see the feeling, and it's got a tight mental fist around it. You see, around your throat, there's all these muscles that are tight. You don't want to cough. You want it to stop. But you relax those muscles. And then if you're going to cough, you let your body be on automatic. If it's going to cough, it'll cough. It doesn't matter. But quite often, when you let go of that tension and tightness around that tickle, that cough will just go away by itself. And sometimes it won't. So the whole process of the Buddhist meditation is learning how this process works. And as you go deeper into your understanding, you go deeper into the meditation. As you begin to go deeper into the meditation, you will have hindrances arise for a little while. That means wandering thoughts, emotional feelings, whatever, sensations. But when you finally start letting go of the attachment to those, when you let go and it doesn't come up anymore, there's a sense of relief. With that sense of relief, right on its tail is joy. And the joy is very big. And it's called uplifting joy. It's a very light feeling in your body. It's a light feeling in your mind. And there's a lot of excitement, and it really feels good. Nice stuff. Now, the joy is going to be there for a little while. And then it's going to fade away. And then you're going to feel more comfortable in your mind and in your body than you've ever felt before. And this is what the Buddha called happiness. And you're also going to feel very tranquil, very peaceful, very calm. Your mind will just stay on your meditation without any effort at all. If there is a slight thought that comes up, you're able to see it very easily and quickly, let it go, relax, and come back. Now, what I just described to you was the first stage of the meditation. And in Pali, they call this a jhana. This is a lot different than the kind of jhana that is generally described, because you have to have insight in order to be able to experience the jhana. Insight into what? Insight into the process of how this stuff works. Yes?
I have a question. Like, each time when you're involved with a hindrance and you relax and you return, you're sharpening your mindfulness.
Yes.
Right? Does something similar happen when you're in a jhana?
Yes.
So you're sharpening your mindfulness as well.
Yes.
So it's beneficial to stay in a jhana for a while.
It's beneficial to stay in a jhana as long as possible. Why? Because your mind is very pure at that time. You're staying on a wholesome object. There's no hindrance that can arise when your mind is focused on a wholesome object. Not focused in such a way that it's like glued to it. But when your mindfulness slips a little bit, if your mind gets tired, whatever reason, you can look forward to having a hindrance arise, and now you got to work with that again. But the hindrance is very much necessary for you, because your hindrance is your teacher. This is showing you where your attachment is. This is showing you where you're identifying with your thoughts and your feelings. This is showing you how to let go of those identifications. And when you let go enough, they won't arise anymore. You'll go deeper into your meditation. You start seeing more clearly how this process works. Now you start to get a lot of self-confidence. You're starting to really understand, and the joy that you experience is much more intense, and it's so uplifting that I've had people that say, I had to open up my eyes and look because I thought I was going to hit the ceiling. Okay, it's a very uplifting feeling. It's a very happy feeling. When that fades away, you feel even more comfortable in your mind and your body. You feel more still. You feel very tranquil and peaceful and calm. Now, I've just described to you the second stage of the meditation. And the only way you can get to really experience these kind of things is by seeing how the process works. And you see very clearly that this is part of an impersonal process. You don't ask a hindrance to come up. You haven't said, well, I haven't been angry for a while, I might as well be angry now. Or I haven't been restless for a while, let's be restless. They happen by themselves, and you don't have any control over them. You can't make them come up, you can't make it go away. All you can do is see it for what it truly is. Let go of the thoughts, relax, let go of the feeling, relax, come back to your object of meditation. It doesn't matter how many thousands of times you do this. Every time you do it, you're seeing a little bit more clearly how this process works. You're seeing a little bit more clearly how the cessation of suffering actually takes place. And because we're slow learners, and I include myself in that, we have to do it a whole bunch of times before we really, and then all of a sudden we'll do it one time and go, well, of course, that's the way it works, I see that. But you've only had to do it a few tens of thousands of times before you get that realization. It's a matter of practice. And it's not just practice while you're sitting in meditation. It's practice all the time, watching what your mind is doing. See, when you start handling hindrances the way that I'm talking about, you're able to see hindrances come up with your daily life. You see how dissatisfaction arises and how your mind sometimes just dulls out for no good reason, or gets restless for no good reason, or it has a lot of lust in it. You'll see how this process works, and you'll stop identifying with it so deeply. And then that means the emotional roller coaster starts to level out. It's not so you won't have such high highs, but you won't have such low lows either. And before long, then it's more like little waves that are happening, and you don't get caught by these emotional snits and really identify with them so heavily. And that is relief. And that is the cessation of suffering. Letting go of those kind of emotional attachments, emotional identifications that everybody has. Everybody gets involved with their emotions in one way or another. But with practice, you start gaining more and more a sense of balance. And it's not just balance while you're sitting, it's balance all the time. And with that comes more clarity of mind. And with that comes being in the present moment more of the time. And with that, happiness arises. Now, one of the things that I tell people when they're practicing loving kindness is, I want you to smile. And I want you to smile all the time. And I want you to practice your smiling. Why? Because the corners of your mouth go up, your mental states go up. when your mental states go up, it's more easy to have joy arise. And when you have joy arising, your mind is very clear, your mind is very bright, your mind is very agile. And you can see when you start getting heavy doubt. And you can go, oh, I don't need to cause this suffering to myself, let it go. And developing your sense of humor, being able to laugh with yourself for being so crazy, is part of having joy arise. Now, meditation is actually, there's three parts to the meditation. And I found in this country, most people are more interested in just calling meditation sitting. This is my meditation. I'm going to do this quiet time. But that's not really the way the Buddha taught. He said, first part of meditation is practicing your generosity. Now you practice your generosity with your speech, and you practice generosity with your body, and you practice generosity with your mind. That pretty much covers it all, doesn't it? Say things and do things that make you happy and makes everybody else around you smile. Easy, right? Say things and do things that will help other people to lighten their load. And when you think of them kindly. That's one of the parts of the sitting meditation that you'll find is very helpful. When you're practicing your generosity, it's very easy once you practice sitting with loving kindness. After a while, it's very easy to have good thoughts about other people because you're practicing that.
So that helps you with more joy arising.
Right.
And that creates your mind brighter, so that makes it easier for you to see the process.
Right.
Which lessens your suffering.
Right. And it lessens everybody else's suffering around you. You affect the world around you, whether you like to believe it or not. And it's your choice in how you do it. The next part of the meditation is keeping the five precepts, morality. Now, this is a dirty word in this country. And I know people that they do retreats, and they say they're going to do the precepts one time during the retreat, and then they pretty much do whatever they want after they take the precepts. They don't really pay much attention to the precepts. But the precepts are something to keep in your mind all the time. There's only five of them. It's a piece of cake. You don't kill or harm living beings on purpose. And that means mosquitoes, cockroaches, alligators, whatever. You don't take what is not given. You don't steal anything. You don't have wrong sexual activity. That means sexual activity with someone too young, sexual activity with another person's mate, sexual activity by going to or paying people. Okay. You don't tell lies. You take the precept not to tell any lies, not to use harsh speech, not to gossip, not to slander. And you don't take any drugs or alcohol. Why don't you take any drugs or alcohol? Because your tendency to break the other four precepts is real big when you do. So you don't do that. Now these five precepts, what they do is they help you develop a kind of mindfulness of your awareness of what you're going to do before you do it. and you make a conscious decision either to do it or not do it. Not to harm someone else. Not to say something that's not true. As you do this over a period of time, your mind will become more and more peaceful and calm. Then you're ready to sit in meditation. But a lot of people that do retreats in this country, they do lip service to keeping these precepts, and then they practice for a week or 2 weeks or a month or 3 months, and the first part of their meditation is really difficult because they didn't keep their precepts. Now all of the remorse and anxiety and guilty feeling they have for breaking the precepts, now they have to work through that before they're ready to progress in the meditation. And then they get done with the meditation, they don't pay attention to the precepts, they go back and do things the way they've always done them. Then they come and do another retreat, and it's very difficult. So the progress is not very good. And keeping these precepts is incredibly important. It directly affects the amount of hindrances that arise while you're in your practice. So you practice your generosity, you keep your precepts, then you're ready to sit in meditation. And that's what the practice is all about. It's not just this sitting like a log, like a, what was it that Antro said, a mushroom on a log? That's not meditation. It's about living your life, but living it in a way that you do and say things that make you and everybody else around you happy. And when you see that what you're doing doesn't lead to that happiness, then stop doing that. Change old habits into new habits. Start doing things that make everybody smile. The more you can do that, the lighter your mind becomes. The lighter your mind becomes, the sharper your awareness is. The sharper your awareness, the sharper your mindfulness. So you can see when your mind starts to go down. And you can let go of that and relax and have it uplifted again. It's all about being happy. And you do the practice like it's a game. Don't get heavy with it. Don't try too hard with it. Asians need to try real hard with it. We don't. We're already too serious. They're happy-go-lucky folks. They feel like they have all the time in the world to attain whatever needs to be attained. We feel like we don't have any time at all. I've got to go here and do this, and I've got to go there and do that. I haven't got time to mess around, so I'm really going to go at it really hard. But it has to be in a balanced way. It has to be in a balanced way.
That's interesting. We got pinched from both ends, and we lost what it was.
Yeah.
You know, the potential. That's interesting.
So, any other questions? It's okay if you have some, you can ask.
So, understanding that these precepts affect your Dixon Dunn, right? Because I can imagine when I just started, that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But after a while, it did.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I was curious about, slow progress, when you just start, like really just start.
It's gradual progress.
Right, but
gradual
like,
practice. It all comes down to how you live your life. there are some students that I have had in Asia that have practiced their life in a way that is very exemplary. Very, very kind people, helpful people. They go out of their way. They would give you the shirt off their back. They would never even consider killing anything or breaking any of the precepts. They come to the meditation and in one day they get into the first jhana. But that's not talking about the 40 years of practice that they've been doing before that. And it's pretty much hit and miss. I mean, of course, there's going to be times when you might make a mistake and break one of the precepts, but you don't want to be overly critical of yourself and cause yourself a lot of fear and anxiety and that sort of thing. If you break a precept, then you realize, and when you realize that you broke it, then you stop. You make the determination that you're not going to break that precept again. You forgive yourself for making a mistake, and then take the precepts again. And I very strongly recommend that everybody practice the precepts, taking the precepts every day. And very seldom do people do that sort of thing. But it's not as a rite and ritual, but as a reminder that you want to keep these precepts in, you want to keep them without a break. You don't want to have any breaks in your precepts at all. And as you do that over a period of time, your mind will naturally start to settle down. And the hindrances just don't arise anymore. So somebody in Asia, smart Alex that they are, they said, okay, I'll keep the precepts. How long do I have to do that? And I said, well, we can start at 100 years and go up from there. You want benefit, the longer you can live without breaking a precept, the better your meditation becomes.
So the precepts are directly related to the hindrances.
The precepts are directly related to the hindrances.
It's like a tit for tat.
Okay.
I have a question about one precept in particular.
Yeah?
I want to speak more about gossiping. I feel like I gossip sometimes.
So gossip is talking about someone that's not around,
mm-hmm.
but making up stories about them, not saying the truth about them.
So what if you're talking about somebody that's not there, but you're telling the truth from their perspective?
Then that's not gossip.
Mm-hmm.
But it's best not to do that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have you ever been to some place like you see a house on fire and you know the people that were in that house and you're standing out and you're watching the house and all of a sudden people start talking about things that, I mean, it's just really gossip is what they're just making up stories about what's in the house and what's being lost and all of this sort of stuff and they're just making up stories as you go along and you hear one person say it and then you hear somebody over here tell somebody else the same story, but it doesn't have anything to do with the reality of the situation. That's gossip. Yeah, it's like that. And slander just means trying to make someone else hate the person that you hate. It's basically, well, it's like trying to put a split between two people. And that's what slander is.
What were we referring to about Spirit Rock?
psychotherapy.
And what does it mean by that?
That's what they're trying to pass off as vipassana these days.
Really?
Yeah.
What teachers are doing that?
Jack Kornfield, to start with.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you read some of the things he says, he'll say things like, 60% of the people that come for a 3-month retreat don't get any benefit from a 3-month retreat because they need to go through psychoanalysis first.
Oh.
And that's completely shocking.
Yeah.
Because there's something wrong with the teaching if that's the truth.
The most recent one that really disturbed me, I'll say it disturbed me. Because he's such a well-known teacher, and he made a statement in a recent magazine, in an article, that referring to equanimity and imperturbability as a state, the only thing that has that in the world is a dog. It's not possible for a human to have that. It's the implication in the discussion with kind of children on the stage. And I was totally shocked. Because I knew there was a disconnect between what was originally taught and what they were doing, but I had no idea that they would come out with something as blatant like that, because I had just had a discussion a month before with someone who was arguing imperturbability is not a real state and it's impossible to achieve it. And I knew the moment that you dismiss equanimity and imperturbability as a state, then the Buddha didn't do anything outside of any other kind of meditation. And the struggle kind of seems to be it kind of seemed to be that all meditation is the same, but that's not real. And we came up with something the other day about, like, there's so many different objects of meditation, but the way the meditation was done was all the same. But
the way that the Buddha taught the meditation was the same.
He had 40 or 50 objects, but the methodology of the what he was doing was the same, with the same goal, with the same destination, with the same intention to help me. You could choose to use a kachina, you could choose to use
a kachina,
you could choose to use on the breath, you could choose to use loving kindness, or any of the other 40 or 50 that existed, objects of meditation. But somewhere, the language got changed to all meditation that's done in the world is the same. If that's true, the Buddha didn't do anything significant at all. You have to dismiss him. And that's not real, because he did do something significant. But I was just kind of surprised that he said that about the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a joke. It was a serious statement. You know?
What do you think of Adyashanti?
Of who?
Adyashanti.
Don't know. Anybody that's teaching meditation, if they aren't teaching the extra step of relaxing in between letting go and coming back to your object of meditation, they are teaching a form of one-pointed concentration, and that the Buddha did not teach. He practiced it when he was a bodhisattva. He went as far as he could go with that practice. And then he said, this isn't it. One point of concentration doesn't work. I don't care if you call that concentration moment-to-moment concentration, it's still concentration, and it's still one point, a form of one-pointed concentration. If you don't add that extra step every time of relaxing, then you're not practicing in the way that the Buddha taught.
You're the only teacher I've ever known that taught that relaxation.
I know.
Yeah, you know, this summer we had a Burmese scholar that was there, a monk, so we got a chance to sit at the table and really dig this out. And he had the Burmese translation.
He didn't have a Burmese translation. He had a Burmese script of Pali.
That was
of the Tripitaka and
right.
of
and the commentaries and right. sub-commentaries.
And what was interesting, because I'm always looking at this, I'm always trying to figure out something that substantiates it, okay? And it's pretty easy when you go to Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the breathing meditation, the Anapanasati, or you look in four other suttas, it appears four or five times. And the phrase revolves around one word, and the word is tranquilized. And the argument that I was confronted with this summer with something that I was writing was that the Buddha meant that we should practice the meditation until we reach a state of tranquilization. And that's not what it says. And he said, oh, this is just what it says. And this was someone who was in Burma. So because he was there, the Burmese scholar, we sat down and said, okay, I want to know. Let's substantiate what he's teaching. How do we do this? So we went to the text. Word, in their language, they use the same word, whether it's a noun, a verb, or an adverb, or an adjective. It's the same word with a little different way of saying it. And I said, you need to explain this to me, which word is being used. So we went and found the word, and there's just no way around it. The word is being used as an adverb, which describes how you do an action. It's around verbs here we're talking about, not nouns.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is significant because the three words preceding the word tranquilize, it's he trains us.
Mm-hmm.
And that appears hundreds and hundreds of times in the sutta. So if he trains us, what does he do? He tranquilizes. What does he tranquilize? He tranquilizes the bodily formation. He tranquilizes the mental formation. You see? There's no way around it. So the guy had to totally back down. But what was more interesting was finding how it was substantiated in the suttas as that way, then removed away in the commentary work to saying something else that blurred it. But then in the sub-commentary work, which are not translated into English yet for us to even see, it takes it back to the sutta's meaning. So when you start to examine all of this, it isn't just one reason that he's teaching the way he's teaching. He's teaching it because it's substantiated in the text. And every time it tells you to go to the root of a tree or into a hut, that's the expression used to repeat that set of directions again and again and again and again and again in hundreds of teachings. It's really neat when you really start to look at where did this come from and how did it get lost. I had 100 women once make a pound cake for a church. They all had the same recipe. Have you ever made a pound cake?
Yeah.
You know how if you take them out of the oven too soon, they'll fall?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, they'll come out squishy if you don't mix it properly. See? And it's one tiny little thing. And it's so tiny. And we're looking at 2,500 years. And we're also looking at this commentarial work that came into this country before these were translated into English. And that first string of teachers did the best that they could do with what they had as a main source. But they don't want to back up and read the whole suttas. They're too accustomed to wanting to use excerpts to explain things, which is very comfortable because it's always been done that way. So they
plus
one little tweak.
Plus, there's an awful lot of people in this country that are freelancing with Dhamma talks. And by freelancing, I mean, I actually practice yoga, so I'm going to throw in some yoga's ideas with Buddhist words, and it's all the same thing anyway, you know.
That went from the...
And if you go get the Insight magazine... Not the Insight, Inquiring Mind magazine, you'll see advertisements for Christian Buddhism. And you'll see advertisements for the Hindu Buddhism. And
it's a free for all.
Yeah, it really is. And this happens because people will try the meditation for a little while and they're not satisfied with the end result, so they try something else. If somebody is willing to just practice what I'm showing you right here, which is not my teaching, it is the teaching of the Buddha, you will start to progress so fast it'll blow your mind. And you'll know whether you're doing it right or not, because you hear in other suttas, and it starts reinforcing over and over again what your experience really is. Yeah, it is.
It's fun to look at the historical thing. You can get lost with it, and really, I went off on a tangent for months at one point, and still do sometimes. I have to pull myself out of it. But you got to stop and think. Whatever he did, when he did it, the whole world became Buddhist that was there at that time.
In that area, you bet.
And it had, you know, one of the
most... It had to work. It had to work well. It had to work quickly.
Farmers and people who live up in the hills and are out in the country in that, you know, small villages, they don't accept stuff unless it's logical, they can apply it to life, it makes sense, and it works, you know. It just doesn't make sense that it would have been something that took you 11 or 15 or 20 years to get to. It doesn't click. When you start reading all of the accounts all over the place, it doesn't mesh. And
seven
what
days, right?
You know, what
7 days.
Me, what surprises me is, you know, the elements here are that we live in, like he's saying, we live in a fast society. You grew up with a mall mind. You know, my mother didn't, but I was introduced to it, and my children have mall minds. They don't go to one store to get something. They go to 20, you know. They'll go to a mall for the day just to shop. They have this mindset, and that you can have stuff like that and you can figure stuff out like that. So if you can't, we need to mix, you know, mix it up. And Americans also, Yankee ingenuity, look at us. We've been branded with that for more than half a century or more, the Yankee ingenuity thing. And we want to just, well, we got to fix it. Okay, let's do this, 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 and this. It has nothing to do with fixing the gate, but we can jerry-rig it. You know, so we're pros at doing that. And we didn't look historically, and it moved around geographically. After the Buddha died, for a long time, they were getting what it was and injecting it inside of the existing religion here, 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 here. And we got these different things that occurred. By the time it came to our country, it was one of them. What's the story that you tell about the guy who told you at the retreat every morning they recited something?
He went to a Zen retreat, and he did the English version of the Japanese version of the Chinese version of the Sanskrit version of the original Pali.
So,
what do you think they were really doing?
And then in our country, we're readily prepared to accept things like going to, Guru Mindship and Asananda, you know, Muktananda, and sitting there and chanting for an evening without knowing anything or saying at all. We're happy as larks. I did that.
Oh, you did?
I had lots of people. Sure, I did it in D.C. for 3 years and studied their correspondence course. And I loved it. I thought it was great and very peaceful. It made me feel, and somebody said to me, what's it mean? I have no idea. No idea at all. I was a victim.
So you might as well have been saying banana over and over again. Because at least you know what a banana is.
We have a joke about it. But the point is that, Bhante's teacher that died last year, one of the things he really tried to do for American students was he created the paritas, which are the a set of suttas that all the monks...
They're called the protections.
Protections. In Pali, with a Pali verse and English verse, Because of where he was in a Burmese monastery in America, which meant that he was in a Burmese community center for Burmese immigrants to a large extent. And he created this. It didn't go out because nobody Burmese wanted to take it out and introduce it to Americans, and there weren't any Americans at this particular center, and so it just never happened, and it sat there for many, many years. And now a Burmese monk came, and I was trying to learn it, and he was helping me learn it, But he took it back to Boston, and he's doing it with a couple people and trying to get it started, because Americans aren't chanting with an English translation. And if they're going to chant, they should at least, he was excellent, really good. He would do the poly.
25 words.
Oliver's name. I'm done.
Okay.
He's got the whole book.
But one of the things that happened when I came back from Asia with my teacher was I gave him a copy of a book that I wrote. And he wasn't completely thrilled with what he read. Okay, but it did agree with what it said in the sutta. And I left and started traveling and going around, and without his asking me or telling me, he took my book and he put it on the website. So anybody can go and get it. And this was 5 years ago,
about
I think.
5 years, that's
yeah.
Years, we can trace that one. And they also
and there's been more than a half a million hits on his website front. It's amazing. And he did that, but he knew that what he's teaching wasn't quite right, but he'd been teaching the same thing for so long he couldn't change. But he helped me out immeasurably with that. So
the book approaches the level of silly, where no one tells Bhante what's going on with it, and we know we're over 500,000-600,000 copies worldwide, and we know we're in 5 languages, and it just grows on its own by itself, and it's
yeah.
Kind of an interesting.
It's really kind of funny. Somebody wrote to me and they said, "I want to translate your book into Russian." And I thought, well, that's good. Why don't you send me a copy so I can take a look at it? He sent it to me, and I can't read Russian. Oh, good translation. Thanks. I have no idea what he wrote. That happened with the Korean.
The Korean translation and the Russian translation, we don't have any way to look at them and have somebody improve them. But the Spanish now is beginning to, they're beginning to catch up. And the Dutch, there's the Dutch.
Well, what's the hang up?
Watching how crazy my mind is.
So, do you have any question?
No.
Okay. You? I realize that there's not very many people that are teaching the way that I teach, at least yet. But because it was introduced into this country when Jack and Joseph, they came back from Asia in 1974, they started teaching the Vipassana the way that the Burmese teach the Vipassana. And they became very popular because of that. Joseph and I correspond with each other occasionally, maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And he's starting to come around more and more, and he's starting to realize that there's more to it than what he's been teaching. Jack, I've tried to write to a few times, he never responds. But he's kind of an attached little guy. But eventually Buddhism is going to change into this, because what the insight knowledge is and the way that the people teach straight insight. When I started doing that, I practiced for 5 years before I found out what the meditation wasn't. And then it took a while to figure out what it was. And I went through all of the insight knowledges like they talk about. But it didn't lead to the end result that the Buddha was talking about. You notice how I talk about dependent origination. Do you hear that sort of talk with Vipassana groups?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Paul did it a couple of times during lectures on only on dependent origination.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, according to, let's see, there's one book of suttas where there is, 78 suttas on dependent origination, just by itself. But a lot of people don't connect that dependent origination is what you have to realize before you attain Nibbana. You have to see it, you have to know it. That means you have to be practicing it all the time. And it's very much necessary. And that's what happens, is you get to a state where there's a cessation of perception and feeling. Then when the perception and feeling come back up, you see all of the links of dependent origination. You see the cause and effect relationships, and you see how they cease. That's not Nibbana yet, but that understanding is so profound that Nibbana occurs. And Nibbana is an unconditioned state. In other words, you've completely let go of all conditioned thinking and all conditions. So you can experience the unconditioned state. Jack and Joseph, the way they're teaching, it's seeing impermanent suffering and not self. That's the way you experience Nibbana. And that doesn't have anything to do with dependent origination.
That's how Matt teaches too.
Yeah. But it's over the years. I started years ago teaching dependent origination, but it's become more and more and more, because that's the core teaching. And that is the Four Noble Truths. They're involved in that. Each one of the links. You can take the word suffering out, you can put that link in. And what's the cause of that? And what's the cessation of that? What's the way leading to the cessation of that? And that's what it's done in the suttas. So it's very necessary to have deep understanding in how the process works, how this is an impersonal process. And it sure seems personal sometimes when a hindrance arises. It seems like this is me, this is who I am, I have to find out why this feeling is there, I need to know why. No, you don't. You need to just watch how the process works. That's the way to the cessation of suffering. Hmm? Well, he who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. He who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination.
Okay, but the other one was in the Vinaya about he who sees dependent origination sees the three characteristics, but he who sees the three characteristics does not always see dependent origination. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens?
Oh, that's mentioned in the Sutta?
Yeah, it's mentioned in the Vinaya, in a section of the Vinaya, and because of that, the clue is given, it's left there, that to take dependent origination and look at it in this way. And when you go through the suttas, it's in the meditation anyway. I mean, I know that you can present it across the three lifetimes, and a lot of people teach it across the three lifetimes. And you haven't done that, but you've probably been exposed to it. If they've taught it, they've probably referred to the Visuddhimagga and the teaching and breaking it into the three lifetimes when they taught the dependent origination. Did they talk about it in that regard?
At least they make it complicated.
Well,
oh yeah.
Buddhism is not a simple yellow mix. You know, when you're cooking. I mean, it's like...
Well, yeah, it is. That's the problem.
Well, it is, but it seems to me that almost every piece of it is gradual realization and levels of realization in seeing how it works. And so, like, it's difficult to say, you know, just say it and have everybody in the room understand it the same way. You know what I mean? So,
right. Remember that gradual training when you talk to Jane next time.
Yeah. All right. She's the exception. But see, that's,
she was
that's
amazing.
Like the argument of dry insight. See, I get so... it's just... Okay, let's see a nice word. It's a challenge to hear somebody talk about dry insight, and this is, we'll do this because we want a dry insight. But you see, the dry insight person
is the fluke.
It's the person that who reaches the achievement the goal by just listening to Dhamma and not doing what is dry insight.
No, I'm not going to talk about dry insight because there's no such a thing.
But somebody
there's no such a thing.
Okay. Okay, now let's say it this way. Don't call it dry insight. If somebody just listens to the Dhamma and becomes enlightened...
They can. No, it's not.
Why is it not a fluke?
Because that's what happened to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Sariputta had happened to. He heard one verse. He heard half of one verse and he became a Sotapanna. Because his understanding was good enough at that time. And the verse had to do with how dependent origination worked. Moggallana, he heard the whole verse and became a Sotapanna. There were a lot of people that when your mind is sufficiently ready, just by listening, that's one of the reasons that I read the suttas, because I don't want you to think that it's me. And if your understanding is good enough, just by listening to this, you can attain Nibbana. But your understanding has to be mature.
Jane was sure ready to take off.
Amazing. So one of those kind of people you want to go...
She had like, what, 9 days?
Eight.
8 days.
She went into the Arupa Jhanas, which is really amazing to go that fast.
But understood too. I mean, she really understood.
She got into the realm of nothingness. In eight days.
8 days. Well, this we're discounting the 4 years before.
She's not 40 yet. She has done a lot of meditation at some point in past lifetimes, I'm sure. Talking with her, you would never believe that she was really, really that intelligent or really that wise. Because she's kind of a talks in a scattered kind of way.
She's got a real interesting brain.
Anytime I say anything, she's right there and she understands what I'm saying.
It doesn't take
a lot for me to say. I mean, just give her the idea and her mind goes with it and she understands it in like 50 different ways. It's really amazing to watch. Anyway, why don't we share some merit? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth Devas and Nagas of mighty power share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu.